of the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. ...1934, that was the year.
Everything all set?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
Taking off from the Naval Aviation Base in San Diego, California, about 2:20 on the afternoon of January 10, the six planes of Flight Squadron 10F, U.S. Navy... were heading, naval authorities said, toward Hawaii, in nothing more than routine movement of fighting equipment. Actually, this history-making expedition was to be, if successful, the longest span that six heavier-than-aircrafts had ever attempted. 24 hours, 56 minutes later, an anxious nation heard Lieutenant Commander Nelpha McGinnis speak via shortwave broadcast across 2,400 miles of Pacific Ocean from Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
I am glad the flight is behind me. It was a tough trip over, with low clouds and fog in our path from 7 o'clock last night until early morning. But it was no worse than the night flying we've experienced off the coast of Mexico and around San Diego.
Thank you, Commander. Now, here's Glenn C. Eddy, radio operator of the flagship 10P1. Go ahead, Mr. Eddy.
Thanks. Well, I'm glad to have made the flight. I'd be willing to turn around and fly back again.
And here's another member of the Intrepid crew. Would you like to say something, sir?
Well, okay. All I want to do is go home. Anybody, go home and sleep.
1934. That was the year. Below decks of the steamship Exelana, as it heads toward New York City, is septuagenarian Samuel Insull, Sr., one-time mogul of the widespread powerful corporation securities and other public utility companies. For 2 years, a fugitive from U.S. justice in Greece and Turkey, accused with his son and 15 others of using the mails to defraud to the extent of $100 million. As he comes on the deck of the Exelona.
My son, where is my son? There he is. Junior. Oh, Junior.
Hello, Pop. How are you doing?
Well, fine. Fine. Oh, I'm glad to see you, my boy. Gentlemen, this is my brother. I mean my son.
How about a statement, Mr. Insull?
A statement? Yes. Gentlemen, I am back in America to make the most important fight of my life. Not only for freedom, but for complete vindication. I have erred, yes. But my greatest error was in underestimating the effect of the financial panic on American securities, and particularly on the companies I was working so hard to build. The whole story has not yet been told. You only know the charges of the prosecution. Not one word has been uttered in even a feeble defense of me. I'll give you a written statement later, and I want you to know this is the first statement I've made on either side of the Atlantic. Anything else has been fake.
Now, Mr. Insull, how about some pictures?
Well, all right. But you get away. I'll run this. You know, this is my mug, and I've got a proprietary interest in it.
For 6 months, the Insull trial in Chicago dragged on. Spectators at first numbering hundreds dwindled to 12. On November 24, the jury retires. And after only 3 hours, returns. Judge Wilkerson turns to the jury box.
Have you reached a verdict, Mr. Foreman?
We have.
Hand it to the clerk.
We, the jury, find the defendants not guilty.
...1934. That was the year of one of the most spectacular progressions of crime detection in U.S. history.
February 23.
Chicago, Illinois. Roger Tuohy, Albert Cater, and Gus Schaefer are found guilty of kidnapping John Factor. Sentenced to 99 years imprisonment each.
March 13.
Albany, New York. Manny Struhl is convicted of kidnapping John J. O'Connell, Jr.
May 15.
5 days after they kidnapped William F. Gettle, retired oil operator from his home in California. And but one day after he was rescued by police, James F. Kirk, Larry Kerrigan, and Roy Williams were caught, pleaded guilty at Los Angeles, and sentenced to life imprisonment.
May 23.
On a backcountry road near Arcadia, Louisiana, 28-year-old Texas outlaw Clyde Barrow and his 23-year-old Mal Bonnie Parker were chased by police, slain by a hail of 167 bullets, 50 of which hit Barrow and his girl.
July 22.
Outside a motion picture theater in Chicago stand three quiet, somberly clothed men, preoccupied in the lurid posters advertising a gangster movie. As the picture ends, the audience comes into the lights of the street. The three men watch each person cautiously. At last, one of them approaches a slim man wearing gold spectacles and accompanied by two women.
Hello, John.
Look out, Valley's drawn.
As public enemy number one, John Dillinger reaches for his own gun, a perfectly aimed bullet from the gun of G-Man Melvin Purvis ends the killer's life. His dyed hair, the spectacles, his lifted face fail to disguise him. And one of the most thrilling cases in the annals of crime was closed.
September 19.
At the Warner Quinlan gas station in New York, attendant Walter Lyle approaches a customer.
That'll be $1.68.
Yeah, here.
$20, eh?
Yeah, you don't have to look at it. This is good. I have 100 more like that to get rid of. They're all right. Any bank will take them.
Okay. Here's your change. 1, 68, 72, 3, 4, 5, 10, and 20.
Thank you.
Hey, Wolf, what are you doing?
I'm writing down his license number. 4U1341, New York. There. I do that on every 10 and 20 bill I get. You know, the Lindbergh ransom money.
The next day, Lieutenant Finn, Federal Agent William Seert, and Corporal William Horn of the New Jersey State Police placed Bruno Richard Hoffman under arrest for extortion. When apprehended, Hoffman had on his person another of the $20 bills, part of the $50,000 which Dr. John F. Condon had paid April 2, 1932, for the return of 19-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr., later discovered dead 5 miles from the luxurious home of his parents at Hopewell, New Jersey. In Hauptmann's home in the Wakefield section of Bronx, New York, were found a telephone number of Dr. Condon and serial numbers of two others of the yellow-backed banknotes. In his garage were discovered more than $14,000 of the ransom money and a pistol.
October 8, Flemington, New Jersey.
The Hunterdon County Grand Jury indicts Bruno Richard Hauptmann on charges of murder.
February 14, 1935.
Hauptmann is found guilty and sentenced by Judge Trenchard to death.
April 4, 1936.
Bruno Richard Hauptmann pays with his life for the murder of the Lindbergh baby. And as the climax to the 1934 cycle of crime and crime detection...
Barrington, Illinois, September 27.
Armed with a machine gun, Lester M. Gillis, known to his pals as Babyface Nelson, shoots to death G-Man Herman Hollis, mortally wounds his associate Samuel Crowley. The next day, the body of this killer is found 15 miles away, wrapped in a blanket, killed by one of the 17 bullets the Department of Justice agents had fired at him.
1934. That was the year...
At the ward liner Morrow Castle, carrying her dead skipper and 549 passengers and crew... burned before dawn in a storm 6 miles off Asbury Park, New Jersey. The number known dead, 109. The number of missing, 25.
That was the year?
Well, yes, there is a cheerful note for 1934.
May 28th. The telephone in the office of a Calendar, Ontario newspaper rings out in the dead of night.
Hello.
Is this the newspaper?
Yeah.
Well, tell me, how much will it cost me to print something about my 5 baby girls being born just now?
Well, our rates are... What? Say that again. 5 baby girls born all at once? You mean quintuplets?
And thus did Oliva Dion announce to the world the fact that his 25-year-old wife had just presented him with Yvonne, Annette, Cecile, Emily, and Marie.
1934. That was the year.
That music lovers followed Crooner Crosby's mellow example to sing...
There's a little Dutch meow on a little Dutch hill where the little Dutch stars shine bright. Now a little Dutch boy and his little Dutch girl fell in love by the mill one night. They both had so much moon that Dutch treat, so the little Dutch boy.